Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Jim Champion inspired legions of business leaders with his bestseller, Reengineering the Corporation. In his new book, Outsmart, Champion describes nine companies that have achieved breakthrough growth by consistently outsmarting the competition. Champion tells his fascinating success stories, revealing powerful, counterintuitive strategies for finding distinctive market positions and sustainable growth. Jim Champion is chairman of Perot Systems Corporation's consulting practice and head of strategy for the company. Jim, in your book, you identified ideas to grow your business, and then you tell stories about companies of various sizes that did this.
I actually began by looking at over 1,000 companies, first reading about them. I used a filter of double or triple digit growth for a sustained period of time, 2 or 3 years. So I was actually able to go through and identify from various lists and research about over 1,000 companies that have been growing at that kind of rate.
I'd like you to share with us some of the strategies that you found during these interviews. For example, in your book, you write about a company that spotted a $15 billion market that wasn't seen by its competitors.
Interesting story about a company called SonicBid. It was a company started by a person who had come actually to study music here in Boston at the Berklee School of Music, determined, I think wisely, that he wasn't a good enough musician to make it out there, became a talent agent, but actually began his career by being a talent agent for big acts. What he saw that others didn't see was that there were hundreds of thousands of performers, small, large, well-known, unknown, who aren't represented by anybody and who have no formal mechanism or structure to connect them as performers with promoters or with a person who's got a wedding or a party that they need an entertainer or a band or a singer or a musician for. And so he built what was a technology-built infrastructure that has engaged a community of over 120,000 different performers. And he matches these performers with people who have a need. You know, you can say, why didn't anybody see it? Well, sometimes people see these kinds of opportunities, but they look so big and they look so daunting that they just put them aside. And they say, look, we can't do that. That's such a big problem, such a big issue to take on, that we can't do it. And I think this kind of strategy takes a combination of both seeing an unmet consumer or customer need, as this entrepreneur did, but it also takes a lot of persistence and a lot of work, quite frankly. This is not a business model that's built easily. And in fact, there's a couple of examples like this in the book. There's another example called Part Search that actually took on the challenge of organizing the 8 million different parts that exist out there for consumer electronic products. By the way, 8 million different parts manufactured by almost 600 different manufacturers. Again, sometimes people see these kinds of things, but they're so big and so daunting, they don't have the courage or the persistence to take them on.
Another strategy you suggest in your book is compete by seeing outside the bubble. What do you mean by that?
There are so many companies that are kind of stuck in the presumption or assumptions of how their industry has to operate. They're stuck in the bubble of a set of industry rules, and they have a very hard time thinking outside the bubble. The case example that I used to illustrate that condition and another company that broke through the bubble is a company called MinuteClinic, a company that actually had the courage to take on the medical establishment and take on the medical community that has a very rigid view of how healthcare must be delivered, at least in this country. And by the way, when you go to other countries, there's still that same kind of rigidness in the healthcare industry about the delivery of healthcare. In fact, when I interviewed the CEO, he said, look, Jim, everybody is kind of innovating on the diagnosis and treatment of illnesses and disorders. We're focused on changing the delivery model. MinuteClinic is the storefront clinic. It's the 7-day-a-week clinic where you can bring your child on a weekend if they have a sore throat. So you don't have to go to that other option, particularly in urban communities, the emergency room. Not only is this an efficient way of treating minor illnesses, but it's a very cost-effective way, and it's very consumer-friendly. And what's really striking about this business model is it actually adopts some of the techniques of retailing. Within the medical community, those ideas are oftentimes just rejected. You find clinicians who are so focused just on the treatment, and I'm happy that they are, that they pay little attention to how it is that consumers might have, in fact, a better experience in healthcare.
And individuals who are not feeling well, who go to the emergency room, probably have to wait hours before they're treated.
That's right. And the visit to a MinuteClinic is a $35 to $40 visit. The visit to an emergency room costs you or your insurer about $200. What is fascinating right now, because I have active discussions with people in the healthcare industry about this delivery model, is that there are intelligent and aggressive healthcare administrators, people who run hospitals, who are saying, look, we have to put a MinuteClinic capability or facility inside our emergency room. So when someone comes in with a sore throat, we don't put them next to the person with gunshot wounds. It's a smart form of triage. But back to your question, the healthcare industry is in a bubble, and delivering healthcare effectively to everyone will take bursting that bubble.
How about the strategy you describe as tapping the success of others?
You know, there are a lot of interesting phenomena out there if you're observant and willing to ride on someone else's success. There are two stories in the book. One is the story of gibbets. And if you have Crocs, those are those rubber shoes with holes in them, you know what gibbets are. Gibbets are the decorative items that you fill or your children fill those holes with. It was an idea that came from a mother who was entertaining her young daughters on a rainy day by making objects that could fill the holes of Crocs. It finally grew to a $10 million business. The Gibbets folks sold it to Crocs, and by the time they sold it, I think they were making 300 different kinds of items to just fill those holes. Well, you can look at that and say, boy, that doesn't seem like a very valuable activity, but you know, there is a market for it.
And, of course, it probably increases the value of its main product.
Absolutely. There's another story in the book about an out-of-work computer guy who's lost his job, so he's going to the gym every day, and he loves to listen to music, so he creates a neoprene holster for his iPod so he can work out and listen to music at the same time. His friends like what he's done. He starts to manufacture these things, actually grows it to a $100 million a year business, just selling accessories for principally Apple and Apple-like products. By the way, I said to him, what does Apple think about this? And he said to me, Apple ignores us, which is an interesting phenomenon. It just kind of shows you how some companies, good companies, just simply accept the fact that people will ride on their coattails. Others get more engaged.
Okay. How can you compete by doing everything yourself?
This is an interesting case because it counters some of the contemporary wisdom about outsourcing and offshoring. I'm frankly a believer that offshoring and outsourcing is an appropriate part of a business model for many companies. But I think there are some businesses that produce very sophisticated, at times high technology, but very sophisticated products that are better off maintaining quality by doing everything themselves. And in the book, there's a story about a company called SA Robotics that designs handling equipment for very high-risk environments. And if it weren't for these robots, we'd have people doing this work, like cleaning out nuclear waste tanks or making repairs to chemical tanks. These are large-scale robots that require sophisticated engineering and cannot fail. When you have a business that must maintain that degree of quality, I believe it is a legitimate strategy to simply do everything yourself. Now, that strategy also requires that you have a high-margin product. People will pay what it really costs to maintain everything within one organization yourself and to do everything from design and engineering through manufacturing. That's an expensive strategy. But if you've got a high-margin product, you've got consumers or customers who are willing to pay for it, and you've got a product that's sophisticated, it's a very rational strategy. And there's one other very important side benefit of being able to do everything yourself. This is a company that has a near zero voluntary attrition rate. And the reasons I believe that happens is because all of the associates, all of the employees of this company get to see and experience the product from its inception to its completion and get to experience the excitement and the satisfaction of seeing the process from beginning to end. That's not something that a lot of people in manufacturing get to see these days.
One of the things you say in your book is that the companies that outsmart rely largely on intuition, whereas those that have been outsmarted have relied on research and analysis. Is this really true?
I think it's very true. Peter Drucker used to have a wonderful expression he used to use with his students. He used to say, go walk in the marketplace. And I think what folks in the outsmart companies do is walk in the marketplace physically and electronically. They really sense consumer needs and customer needs, and they develop and hone their sense of intuition. so that when a need comes up, are we going to move right or left with this product? Are we going to add this capability to our offering or that capability? There isn't a lot of analysis that's done. It isn't 6 months of studying the problem or the opportunity. Decisions are made much more quickly. And again, the decisions are made on intuition. Even in large companies, very good managers use their intuition. They see all the research and they see the information that's brought to them by staffs within their organization. But a really good manager, a really good leader, even in a large company, always checks what that information is telling him or her against their sense of intuition. In these outsmart companies, there was intuition acting, and decisions were also made quickly. It was almost the kind of Nike just do it philosophy.
One of the things you suggest is that corporate culture can actually have much more impact on corporate growth than processes, rules, or controls.
If you're lucky enough to have one, you're absolutely right, or if you've been skilled enough to put culture in place. And there are two qualities that I found about the cultures in these outsmart companies that I think really did support their growth. First was the culture of innovation. It was driven top down by typically their founders or their leaders. The whole organization, because it was a top-down driven cultural engagement, became involved in innovation. A company like Shutterfly constantly has ideas bubbling up broadly from the organization and does, in fact, make selections based on some degree of process. But the point I make in the book and what I really believe is that you can put in processes to help innovate and find ideas, but you ultimately want to get to really a culture and a behavior around innovation. Secondly, I think the way culture works in these companies is that you don't find rule books, you don't find procedure books. It's the culture that determines what you do at the moment of truth when a consumer confronts you. You know, I had an experience recently of flying what I always think is one of the best airlines, Lufthansa. I was flying with my wife. She was flying in the back of the plane on some frequent flyer miles. I was flying in the front of the plane on a business class ticket my company had paid $6,000 for. I asked whether my wife might accompany me into the business class lounge, and twice I was rejected. And I said to the person, this is a moment of truth. I paid $6,000 for this ticket, and you won't let my wife come with me into the lounge. An outsmart company, you see, would say, my word, of course, sir, you can take your wife. But quite amazing, when companies are driven by rules and procedures, you get that kind of dumb behavior.
I think they also lost the regular customer.
That's right. Again, I admire that airline. It's one of the better ones. But boy, this is so foolish. This is the moment of truth. You want your people to do the right thing for your customer at the moment of truth.
Jim Champy, thank you for joining us on Edgewise today. The new book is entitled Outsmart.
Thanks. That's exactly what I'd like the book to help people do.
It would be great to hear your feedback on this program, so please drop us an email note at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.